Good morning, everybody. It's past 8:30. We are going to call the Cultural Outdoors Resources Finance Division to order. We have a couple of overviews of organizations today. We'll be hearing from the Minnesota Zoo and the Science Museum of Minnesota. Mr. Emke, we will begin with the zoo's report, and I see you have brought some friends from the zoo. Perhaps you can tell us very briefly about them, and then you can get on with your report.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lee Emke. I'm the director of the Minnesota Zoo, and with me is Peg Adelman, our CFO. And we've also brought a few guests, our Zoomobile program animals and staff, and one of our core volunteers are here today. And I'm going to ask Kevin Weir, who is the supervisor of our Zoomobile, to briefly talk about the animals that we brought today and the program.
Thank you very much. My name is Kevin Weir, supervisor of our Zoomobile program. And our education program at the zoo is wonderful, both for the schools and citizens of Minnesota who come to the zoo. But what's fun of our program is we visit the entire state of Minnesota, literally from Waro to Winona, in the course of a year. With these animals that you see here, along with many others, I personally have a great horned owl here. Her nickname is Annie. And she is remarkable. As you can see from your reactions, imagine the reaction of a kindergartner or a fourth grader at their school when they see something like this coming to visit.
Or a field mouse.
Yes. Very good, very good. Donnie Crook, another naturalist with our program, has a boa constrictor. That one we probably don't typically bring to see kindergartners. We try and not intimidate. But we've got a lot of very fun smaller snakes that we do bring to kindergartners and preschools as well. Jim Greeno, one of our volunteers at the zoo who helps us with our education both on-site and off-site of the zoo, has a chinchilla from South America. And yes, we're pushing our luck with predators and prey here a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Witt.
Thank you for having us.
Mr. Emke.
Thank you very much. I wanted to talk today about a real success story, which is the Minnesota Zoo. Over the last several years, we have developed a strong mission that we believe we're making great progress towards, a strategic plan with a vision to become one of America's top 10 zoos. Again, always underlying our basic mission, which you've seen exemplified this morning, which is to connect people, animals, and the natural world. The strategic plan that we adopted in 2005 had a number of strategic plan priority areas. Obviously, the exhibits and facilities were a 30-year-old zoo, conservation and animal programs, education and guest experience, which all work together, and then making sure that we're getting the word out about the zoo, that our marketing and communications efforts were stronger, strengthening our organization, and all of that being underpinned by fundraising. These are all areas where we've seen, we think, significant success over the last 3 years as part of our plan. Just a little background. Most people are familiar, but it's always good to remind folks that we are a full state agency. We receive both operating and capital support from the state since our establishment and opening in 1978. We're operated by a board, 15 of whom are gubernatorial appointees, 15 of whom are appointed by the board. And we're in a strong public-private partnership with the Minnesota Zoo Foundation, which is our 501c3 support group. It has its own board of trustees, self-elected. I serve as the foundation president, so there's a strong coordination between the fundraising efforts and the operations of the zoo. Our zoo, like most accredited zoos in the country, really has three basic cornerstone missions. Obviously, a living animal collection and the conservation programs that go along with that. Education in all ways, not just environmental education, but education as an overall mission is key. And creating a zoo experience, creating a recreational opportunity, a fun experience for guests is really critical to attracting guests, bringing them back, and supporting the conservation and education missions of the zoo. Some basic facts. In the last few years, our attendance has been growing. This year, we're likely to exceed 1.2 million visitors for the fiscal year. Among those, more than 75,000 visitors are school children coming on field trips and the like. The Zoomobile program that you just saw exemplified visits more as many as 50,000 Minnesotans in 38 counties around the state on an annual basis. We have a very diverse collection of over 2,000 animals, 50 of which are endangered or threatened species. You've also seen one of our many volunteers who make it possible for us to do what we do. We have over 875 of them currently. And our most recent economic impact study indicated that the zoo developed a $95 million annual direct and indirect impact, positive impact on the state of Minnesota. We're an operation that right now is faced with over 200 full-time permanent employees. We staff up during our busy season in the summer. And as a zoo, we're focusing on our core missions of education, conservation, and animal management. And so some of our services, like our retail and food service, are contracted out to vendors who've done a wonderful job of improving our bottom line and our guest service and allowing us to focus on what we do, which is being a zoo. The organizational chart is in the materials that you've seen. Again, it gives you an indication that the zoo, as a very large organization, has it's basically like a small city in terms of the various functions that we have and the staff that supports those functions. We are a state agency, but at this point, 35% of our annual budget, which is about $21 million, comes from the state of Minnesota. The rest comes from a variety of revenue sources, admissions and membership being the biggest ones. I'll talk more about contributions and how that's grown as a portion of our budget significantly over the last couple of years. And the money is spent. Although we have a wonderful animal collection, obviously we have people who take care of the animals in our physical plant, so the majority of our funding is used to support staff at the zoo. This shows a breakout both in terms of staff versus other expenses, but also the various work areas of the zoo, which areas receive the most funding. And interestingly, it's our physical plants, the facilities at the zoo, that require the largest portion of our annual income. I mentioned that we're making great progress on our strategic plan, and the indicators that we're looking at to measure our success include the following list. There are numerous ways to measure how successful a zoo is. We've been asked, how do you measure towards your vision, your goal of being one of the top 10 zoos in America? And there is no U.S. World Report annual ranking of zoos. There's no formal way to actually rank them. So we look at a number of measures, but they include all of these, which I'll talk about several of them at length. Again, we think the last 2 years have probably been the most successful in the entire 30-year history of the zoo. A big portion of that has been capital reinvestment in the zoo, supported largely by state bonding, but also by private investment. And in just the past 3 years, we've completed a complete renovation of the Minnesota Trail, which was one of our original exhibits, which went from being kind of the forgotten stepchild of the zoo to 2 years ago being named by our guests as their favorite exhibit after we did a major renovation, working with many partners, including the DNR and conservation organizations around the state, to make the Minnesota Trail a celebration of Minnesota wildlife and wild places. Our biggest project ever, which opened this past summer, Russia's Grizzly Coast, is a unique exhibit that's received national and even international attention within the zoo community as a breakthrough exhibit, focusing on some wonderful charismatic megavertebrates, our three brown bears, who you see here. This was a project that was many years in the planning, 2 years in construction, and opened, and I'll talk about the impact it's had on attendance and the perception of the zoo. Together with the Grizzly Coast exhibit, we also redid the central public space in the zoo. Our central plaza reopened last summer with a wonderful new interactive sculpture play area that then was the focal point for our guests over the summer. Also improved visitor services, visitor comfort, which has augmented the zoo experience significantly. We're continuing this year with a completely privately funded portion of our central plaza, what we're calling the Woodland Adventure. It will be a nature-based play area with the idea of getting kids climbing trees and crawling on rope bridges and doing the things that we think are at least as important as playing video games, and all of this is going to be opening this summer at the zoo. And as you can see from this graph, the capital investment has had a significant impact. Our attendance, which had been slow, basically flatlined and slightly declining earlier in this decade, has seen pretty significant increases over the past 2 years. We anticipate again this fiscal year reaching and exceeding our goal of 1.2 million. And most gratifying, I think, for us is to look at this graph, which looks at our peak season attendance. We're open year-round. However, between June and August, or June and September, we receive close to 70% of our visitation every year. People come to the zoo in the summer, even though we have a lot to offer year-round. And our peak season attendance, which is where we make hay, essentially, every year, you can see where it was consistently over time, and then this past fiscal year, the June through August period was the best in the history of the zoo, with the exception of the very first year the zoo opened. So we attribute that to a lot of our marketing efforts, to a wonderful series of new exhibits, and also to the fact that we know that people were probably sticking closer to home this summer, not taking long vacations. So that actually, that perfect storm worked for us in this case, of having great new attractions and more reasons for people to visit the zoo. With that, our membership continues to grow. We're seeing folks who realize that the zoo is a resource they want to use more than once a year, or once every couple of years. And our membership level has been climbing steadily to the highest level ever. We're expecting next year to hit close to 40,000 household memberships, which represents close to 175,000 people. The zoo programmatic areas, the biological programs and conservation division of the zoo, out of those 230-plus employees, about 70 are directly involved in animal care, including a very strong animal care staff, and most recently a behavioral enrichment and training program that works to make the zoo animals' lives richer and better, and also interpret that to the public. That's one of our strategic plan initiatives we've been able to add. The zoo's collection continues to be representative and strong. It's about double the size of the animal collection at the zoo when we opened in 1978. And I mentioned conservation. We're involved in rare animal breeding programs at the zoo. We're involved in consulting and assisting with international conservation efforts, including tigers and Amur leopards in Asia, black rhinos in Africa. But closer to home, we've been involved with the DNR and other partners in the study of our iconic Minnesota animal that we all know is in trouble. The moose, there are several theories, obviously, that have been put forward as to why the northern state moose population is declining. Our veterinarian, Tiffany Wolf, has been part of the team that's been working with the animals in the field to radio collar, census, track, and get a sense of baseline health. As part of an overall study to really look at this puzzling and actually kind of scary issue of the decline of Minnesota's icon. Education. I mentioned more than 75,000 students every year come to the zoo. We augment that with an online teacher resource center so that the zoo visit is more than simply a day out at the running around the zoo, but that there's curriculum connections that are made both before the visit and after. We, in addition to the basic field trips, we do offer many classes and tours at the zoo for all age groups. Our monorail is part of our education program. Interpretive naturalists do the guiding on that. And then we do many special events targeted at specific key audiences at the zoo that don't necessarily focus on animals. We do World Language Days where kids learn about nature, but using languages, French, German, and Spanish. Math days, career days, all things that use animals and use the zoo as a gateway, as a way to get people interested in learning in a broader sense. Community programs as well. Our zoo camp continues to be one of our most popular offerings. Family programs, preschool, mentor programs focused on inner city kids who are interested in biology but maybe haven't had the chance to interact with professional staff like ours. Scout programs, overnights at the zoo, all of these are part of our large education effort. And then outreach. We are the state zoo of Minnesota, and as such, we feel the obligation to make sure that we're reaching out beyond Apple Valley or the Twin Cities. Our Zoomobile program is probably the best example of that, but we're also piloting a number of distance learning programs. Most recently, we developed a game with the funding from National Science Foundation, the first time they have ever funded a video game. And I think the theory was better to join them rather than try to fight them. If kids are using them, which they are, how can they be used as an educational opportunity? We partnered with a number of partners, including Yellowstone National Park, a number of other zoos, the International Wolf Center, in developing something called Wolf Quest, which is an online, interactive, multiplayer video game, but focused on kind of the realities of existing as a wolf in a wolf pack. And it's become an international hit in terms of downloads, in terms of a chat room where players are communicating, and that's where probably the most learning is happening. So we're trying to reach out as much as we can, offer our curriculum, our animals, and our resources in ways that people who aren't visiting the zoo can also engage in it. Other partnerships include, many of you know about the School of Environmental Studies, which is located on zoo grounds, now more than 10 years, a great success story there. And we've had some recent partnerships with the Mayo Clinic, which are pretty interesting as well. This is a map of the state of Minnesota, a little hard to read probably from back there, but it indicates where our Zoomobile program, the red dots, where it has traveled in the past few years. This material is in your packet, I believe. And also where we do get school visits, even with the great distance that needs to be traveled to get down here from up north. We have most of the counties in the state are represented either as Zoomobile visits or school group visits. I mentioned the largest portion of our budget goes to our physical plant operations. We are a 485-acre facility with dozens of major buildings and many more minor ones, most of which was built 30 years ago. So we have the infrastructure issues that any 30-year-old facility would have. And so our operations division is focused a lot on maintaining and enhancing our existing physical plant. But it's also about the guest services, creating a wonderful environment for our guests, and then, of course, the whole marketing and public relations aspect of making sure people are aware of the zoo and our offerings. You get a sense here, again, of the diversity of skills and professionals that are represented on our staff, and the budget that is associated with that group. The people end of things, again, guest services, membership, marketing, special events, and the like. Significant investment every year to make sure that our guests are getting a great experience and that people know what's happening at the zoo. And again, back to the indicators of performance. How are we doing against our plan? One of the ways we measure that is to look at how we're being recognized externally, both within the zoo profession and by the community in general. And a couple of, there's been numerous awards we've received over the last few years, but two in particular I wanted to focus on. The Minnesota Trail, which I mentioned earlier, kind of the forgotten stepchild of the zoo, again, but with an in-house renovation job and reopening in 2007, it actually received an award from the Association of Zoos and Aquariums as one of the very best exhibits opened in any zoo in the country in 2007. The only exhibit that was ranked higher was a $50 million new wing at the National Aquarium in Baltimore. So for a much lower investment, we created, we think, a world-class exhibit, which is makes a whole lot of sense as the Minnesota Zoo to have a great Minnesota Trail, which we now do. And just last year as well, Meet Minneapolis, the Convention and Visitors Bureau in Minneapolis, provided the what's called the O.D. Gay Award, which is given every year to normally the Minneapolis institution, which is doing the most for tourism in the Twin Cities, and to have a south of the river facility like ours be named as the top tourism facility in the state of Minnesota last year was a huge honor. And it's a testament to the investment that the state and others have made in the zoo. Speaking of investment, we are in the midst of a campaign to continue the progress of the zoo. This is a campaign that includes the monies that have already been received from the state and anticipated future capital responding pieces, but it's also our first really significant private fundraising effort. It's been going on for 2 years now, and again, despite the economy, we've shown significant success. And I think this chart really demonstrates that well. The Minnesota Zoo Foundation for many years did a baseline fundraising of about $2 million a year, most of which came to the zoo, some of which supported other zoo-related programs. So you can see in the last 3 years, that private fundraising has taken off. Last year, $7.7 million was raised, which was by far the largest amount ever in the zoo's history. Our goal for this year is ambitious, and obviously conditions continue to challenge us in that area, but we're doing pretty well against our current goal. And so the good news is we've been raising private money like never before. Obviously, some of this money comes in the form of pledges that are multi-year, so it's not all cash coming to the zoo, but it does give us a good indicator that we are being perceived by the community as something worth investing in a very significant way, and that the state's investment is being reciprocated by the private sector. These are the grants to the zoo. So with the money that's raised, some of it goes towards long-term capital projects. Again, much of it is in the form of pledges, so it'll be year over year. But you can see that in 2008, the money's actually granted to the zoo by the foundation, $2.4 million. Were the most ever in terms of helping us with our operating budget and with capital projects. That said, we're all in the midst of the most daunting economic conditions of our lifetime. And as a state agency, we have been asked, of course, are responding to the situation with some of the basic things like, you know, there will be no salary increases or achievement awards. The achievement awards portion is especially difficult for us this year because of the great work that our staff has done putting together these wonderful new exhibits and all the success that I've gone over. We will not, at this point, be able to reward many of the people who made that happen. But we also understand the state, the condition of our state economy and the world's economy. We're looking to strictly limit travel. We've essentially frozen hiring with the exception of some critical positions that we needed to fill. We're doing intensive scrutinization of all expenditures across the board. But the good news, again, with the success we've had this year and the previous year, is that we will have a significant carry-forward number that we can use to begin next fiscal year, which will help cushion what we know will be a down year in just about every revenue stream, including, obviously, we're assuming the state appropriation for the zoo. This chart, I think, is telling. Where the zoo was when we were first established in 1978, and this shows in 1980, 58% of the zoo's operating budget came from the state appropriation. That has gone down fairly regularly, and this current fiscal year is at 35%. The rest is being generated internally through revenue streams at the zoo and through the appropriations line. You can see that's now 9% of our total budget. When it started, it was negligible. And that's the background against which we received the governor's budget recommendations this year, which were a 10% cut to our general fund appropriation. That worked out to about a little over $700,000 a year out of what we anticipate to be about a $22 million total budget. Should that be the case, this will, again, the comparison between where we were in 1980, where we will be in 2010, the state appropriation representing 31% of our budget. I might add that the most recent survey from the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, which is the trade or industry organization for all accredited zoos, the national average is that zoos receive about 50% of their operating support from a public entity, whether that be a state, a county, a city, or a regional association. We've been well below that for many years here. We think, again, this kind of balanced equation is probably appropriate. The 10% cut will be, for all agencies, will be difficult to absorb, but we do believe because of the success we've had in the other areas of generating revenue and support that we will be able to continue our progress. So our response, if should we receive the cut, clearly maintaining our high standards of animal care, that can't be compromised. We will do everything we can to maintain our current standards. Public safety is paramount as well. And it's also important for us to maintain the quality of the experience that we're offering our guests, because if we start to degrade that, we anticipate we will see reduced attendance, and then you get into that spiral where the earned revenue is not happening, and a contributed income will probably decrease as well if the zoo is not perceived of as being a success and growing. So all of the decisions we're going to make are going to keep those three variables foremost in our minds as we make the tough decisions. Within the governor's recommendation, we indicated that we would look at a balance, a way to make up that $700,000. We will reduce expenses by at least $350,000. Some of that is through things like, you know, we're already looking at, instead of doing printed reports and publications, we're going to go all online with that. That will save quite a bit of money right there. Other supplies and materials are likely, but we will have to probably look at eliminating or severely restricting some of our programmatic areas as well. But again, ones that don't hurt our animal care standards in public safety or the guest experience. We're also looking at ways to increase revenue. We believe, given the quality experience that we are now offering at the zoo, there is an opportunity to look at our membership fees and perhaps some other pricing adjustments to help make up additional revenue in a time and in a way that's fair to our guests and to our constituents. This idea of a public-private partnership, we've been talking about it for a long time. I think it's finally really starting to happen in a big way, as opposed to some years in the past where it was, the support for the zoo was all on one side or the other. It's been very much hand in glove the last few years. And I think the investment that's being made by the state and by our supporters has some pretty terrific outcomes that we can measure. Conservation of animals, the breeding program, the conservation education that we do at the zoo, the scientific research, all of those are being expanded in a way that directly helps wildlife populations in the wild. Education, obviously, is a cornerstone, and environmental literacy being so important today, we think we are a gateway to getting kids excited about science, learning, maybe not learning facts and figures, but getting the love and the interest that can then translate into better learning and science education in the future. The public support that we've received, we said when we did it that it would leverage private sector support, increase our ability to get sponsorship, contributed income, and the like. The graph I showed you with the growth of our private contributions, I think, is a very strong indicator that that is working. And finally, there's the whole idea of quality of life. This has been talked about a lot, how the state of Minnesota needs and expects to have wonderful public institutions that attract people to the state, keep them here, and offer something of value to all of the folks who live in the state of Minnesota. And creating a destination point, although obviously we are in the Twin Cities, we do more about 200,000 of our 1.2 million guests every year come from greater Minnesota. We're one of the premier destination points for Minnesotans within the Twin Cities region. And again, creating new exhibits like the Grizzly Coast that's unique in the world are really, I think, differentiating our zoo from any other zoo, and we're becoming more and more a destination, not just for Minnesotans, but for people visiting us as well. And I think with that, I will pause and be happy to field any questions or perhaps any that Peggy Adelman might be able to address.
Thank you, Mr. Emke. Are there any questions for Representative Housen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In 2006, the legislature funded four zoos in the state, and then something happened in 2007 and 2008, and at least with the legislature, zoos became something to be ridiculed and certainly not worthy of state funding. And they even became used as campaign, which really upped the ante. How do we turn it around so that we can dare to include you in budget again? I mean, clearly your presentation shows your outreach to the public, and you have captured the hearts of the public. And how do we go about capturing the hearts of legislators?
Mr. Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Houseman, that's a wonderful question. I think being present and making our case, as we've tried to do over the last several years, I believe there are many more state representatives and state senators who do understand the value of zoos and have been supportive than may have been the case in the past. That said, I think the information I've presented to you, we need to obviously make it more visible and just more hits, I guess, on representatives. Because we are, you know, we think that the zoos are serving several valuable social purposes. That whether we're in times of plenty or times of shortage, as we are today, the work we do is vital. And I appreciate and understand your concern about the level of dialogue that happened around zoos last year, which was, in my mind, unconscionable.
Thank you. Ms. Allen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Houseman, if I may add, I think we need to do a better story talking about our education piece, because to me that's the hidden gem that people don't seem to understand what's done. At the Minnesota Zoo, every year we do Spanish days, we do French days, German days, and every other year Japanese days, where language students come in, they do the presentations, we in turn do a bird show in the language, we do a monorail tour in the language, and it gives students who don't normally have field trips in those types of classes an opportunity to actually come in, use the language, talk to each other. We do a math days every year where we actually have students come in and we present math problems that are applied math. So it makes it interesting. If this animal weighs this much, and this is the diet, but this animal is 10 pounds less, then how do you change the diet for that? So it shows his interesting real-world ways to use math. We have the Zoo Safari program, which I think is absolutely wonderful. It's one of the best public-private partnerships that we have, where we have, over the years, found private funding for programs that will take an entire city of, it's either third graders or fifth graders, are where we teach to the state standards. And the private company will fund 100% the transportation costs, admission, a special zoo program, a monorail ride, lunch. It's really the whole day. We work with the teachers beforehand to help them prepare the kids. We have materials for afterwards. And so we just have a number of education programs that I don't think people are aware of, and we need to do a better job of talking about those.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell us a little more about that Mayo partnership for outreach to Mayo, or whatever you were doing with Mayo?
Ms. Adelman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, the Mayo Clinic redid their entire pediatric area a couple of years ago and asked to work with the zoo so that they would fund the production of videos that could then be run in the children's area. In turn, the other thing that they're looking at is they have funded and are in the process of funding different webcams where we can stream live video, for example, of the bears or of the dolphins into the pediatric unit at Mayo.
And then are they available?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, are they available later then for other people to look at, or just Mayo?
Ms. Adelman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, right now we have been able to use the, they produced a beautiful video on the gibbons, and we have been able to use that in other places. One of the things that we're looking at longer term is the whole distance learning. We have fiber laid, And what we don't have is the production facility. That's one of the things that Mayo's been able to help with. But we'd like to get into the schools, so that if it's a school that can't come down because it doesn't make sense, that we can actually stream live. It's not the same as touching a Zoomobile animal, but if you can interact real time and ask questions about those animals and interact with the naturalist, we think that that's providing another education piece in those schoolrooms.
Thank you. Anybody else with any questions? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make a statement that, you know, I commend you for what you're doing for education. I think that's, you know, that's the most important component of what you're doing. And just to add that, you know, personally, I like bears and gorillas.
Thank you for that, Representative Erdahl. We've got that covered. Any other questions for our friends from the zoo? I want to thank you both for your presentation, and as a representative of a district very close to the zoo, I want to thank you on behalf of my constituents, and I'm sure Representative Mack would say the same. And personally, I know there are many days when I come home and ask my wife how her day went, and she looks at me with a faraway look in her eyes and says, thank goodness for the zoo. So thank you for all you do for us down in Dakota County and throughout the state. We'll hear from the Science Museum next. And while we are waiting for them to get going, I would entertain a motion on the minutes from Representative Davids. Moves the minutes, approval of the minutes from February 23. Are there any questions? All in favor of approving the minutes of Monday, February 23, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Minutes are approved. It looks like we are ready. We have our poster boards, and if you please introduce yourself for our tape, and you may begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Dr. Eric Jolly, President of the Science Museum of Minnesota. Joining me today is Brenda Rainey, our Director of Government Relations. Apparently, we have a document for you. Ah, it's my understanding that in addition to boa constrictors and myself as your large charismatic carnivore, there was a request for a picture of your participants enjoying a cultural institution in the state of Minnesota. You might normally find me enjoying birding or tracking on the Mississippi River, delighting in the zoo and tormenting the gorillas and chimpanzees, and that was a chimp handler at one point in time. But here is my favorite cultural institution. 100 plus years ago, across from the current site of the Science Museum of Minnesota, a group of the leading business people of the state gathered to discuss their concerns of how this state would grow and adopt its new wave of immigrants into its culture and lifeblood. And out of that meeting was created the St. Paul Institute of Arts and Sciences, which over a 100-year history morphed into what we know today as the Science Museum of Minnesota. How do I turn this off? That's more of me than anyone should see.
Dr. Jolly, I'd just like to say that Representative Murphy appreciates your participation in assignment number two. Yes, assignment number two. You've been checked off the list.
I appreciate that very much, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. We've also included answers to your 9 questions in our packet, so you will find them addressed there. We were delighted to provide that information. Before I launch into a bit of an overview of what
you know and others think they know about the Science Museum, I did want to point out that in the kits we have a very odd piece of plastic. I would invite you to take out that plastic and enjoy it for a moment.
Sure.
You might look at it and think, what can I do with this? Mm-hmm. Young children might try to use it as a magnifying glass. Others will put it down on its curved side. But if you play just a little, you'll notice something very peculiar about this piece of plastic. You might tap it and notice that it spins. You might tap it on the other side and notice that it still spins in the same direction. You might think, well, that's cute, and spin it yourself in that direction and say, well, that's quite easy. But a few of you, such as Senator Khan, will take it and spin it in the... And no matter how much energy you put into it in the clockwise direction, it will always transfer that energy counterclockwise. Much like raising a child, it will only go in the direction it wants to. This is called a rattleback. They were collectible items for the Roman legionnaires during their conquest of much of Europe. They were found as stones spinning in rivers. And when that stone spins and spins and spins, it eventually spins off of its axis in such a way that it will only transfer energy in one direction. And so we have here a piece of plastic, which is art imitating life. I hope you'll enjoy the rattleback.
Dr. Jolly, I will. In fact, I think you just gave me my first week's lesson plan for physics next year.
Thank you. Yeah. My appreciation. It's a wonderful piece. We have at the Science Museum of Minnesota in the last few years focused ourselves very heavily on creating the kind of engagement that allows teachers, parents, and policymakers to look to young people and map out a future. An essential future. We believe fiercely that science is the literacy of the future. It's an essential literacy, and it's essential on many dimensions. It's essential for economic participation. When the U.S. Department of Commerce listed 3 out of 5 new jobs that will be created in the next decade paying more than minimum wage will require fluency in science, technology, engineering, or mathematics, we know that our children's hope for economic participation rest in their ability to work in these fields. We know that it's a sector of our economy which, even in today's hard downturns, has grown 4 times faster than the rest of the economy in the United States and is projected to grow 3 times faster over the next decade. Science is an essential literacy for economic participation, but it's also essential for civic participation. I just returned from testimony at the European Union Parliament building in Brussels. And in Europe, they are regulating imports from the United States agricultural sector because of myths over genetically modified organisms. If we want to be a state that is at the center of genetically modified design, of stem cell research, of water recovery and abatement, we need a citizenry that can talk fluently about the issues of science in their day-to-day life and public policy. It is sad to me that, according to the National Science Foundation, 48% of American high school graduate surveys cannot accurately identify that it takes the Earth 1 year to revolve around the sun. These people vote. I fear they could be elected. It is a frightening thought. We need to be concerned about our scientific literacy for the good of our national economy and our nation's well-being in public policy and civic engagement. Science is an essential literacy, yet it is one which is neither broadly nor equitably distributed. I am proud to be in a state with the highest ACT scores in the nation and ashamed to have to admit that we have the largest achievement gap between blacks and whites on the ACT in the nation. Because it means we know how to teach and we're not succeeding in doing so for all. The Science Museum wants to address these issues and many more. We have a 100-year heritage of preserving the culture, the history, the traditions of this state, and turning those stories into things that are important to the contemporary world. Today, that contemporary world is an interaction with arts and sciences that cannot be separated.
that is as old as the Roman rattleback, a story of inquiry about what we see and engage in around us. The Science Museum does many things, and I know many of our members have seen our wonderful collections and work, but if I can take a minute to highlight a few of those things that I'm most proud of and then tell you where we've been and where we're going, I'll be happy to answer questions about how you can invest in that future. We are the largest provider of teacher professional development in math and science in the state of Minnesota. We do more teacher training in math and science than the university, and we do it effectively. I'm a scientist. When we put together our first science teacher training program and math teacher training program, we built evaluation into our budget. We know from our research that when a teacher goes through a program at the Science Museum of Minnesota, their students, we know the teachers like it. That's a wonderful thing. But do the students learn? And we know that their students, of those 1,500 teachers we trained last year, compared to other students, have decreased absenteeism, higher homework completion rate, and greater achievement in mathematics. Our programs work. Our programs pair dollars from the school system, the Science Museum's basic budget, the state, and great funders like Cargill and 3M to provide more teacher training and professional development for fewer dollars than anyone else in the state on a measured for success basis. We know it works. But we're not just the largest provider of teacher professional development. We're also reviewed for our exhibits and our programs. We want to spark interest and conversation. Last year, the Science Museum of Minnesota received more National Science Foundation funding. This is peer-reviewed competitive funding. Minnesota, the Science Museum of Minnesota received more National Science Foundation funding than any other museum in America, and more funding than the combined totals of the Smithsonian institutions. Our peers believe what we do works, but our peers don't always have the courage to lead like Minnesotans do. We are the largest exhibit construction company in any science museum in America. Our exhibits travel the world, and they travel across the United States. Last year, we put together an exhibit called Water Plant, Wild Music. We got it. The Music of Nature. It was a wonderful exhibit. We had Eric Clapton celebrate his birthday at our exhibit. Prince stopped by and played the instruments. We had a great time watching for the celebrities. Before we even started construction on that exhibit, the storyboards for it alone allowed us to rent 3 years to museums all around the country. We were proud of that. The same year, we put together an exhibit on race, an exhibit that challenged our citizens to discuss community, values, culture, identity. Remember Wild Music? 3 years of rental based on the storyboard. Race was about to open, and we had zero rentals. I had a dozen science museum presidents who had called me and said, "Aren't going to be first on the list?" I said, "Great, I will send you a contract." And they said, "No, after we see if you survive." In the state that has the largest attendance and membership in public radio, a state that supports its zoo, a state that supports higher education incredibly well, I didn't have the fear that my colleagues did. We opened the exhibit on race. Within 1 week, we had sold out a 3-year run of the exhibit. We had to extend it to 4 and then 5 years. And finally, when the Smithsonian called because they want to have a joint session of Congress on site in the exhibit, we extended it for 5.5 years. We're now building a second copy because we have 31 museums around the nation on our waiting list, in addition to the 5-year run. This exhibit won the American Association of Museums Award for the best exhibit, period. That's the best exhibit of art, science, natural history, and history. We beat Picasso. And we did it with an exhibit that created conversations and discussions about identity and who we are, that was the finest example of how you inspect the culture of your community and build a civic society by understanding how we interact science, culture, and community in one exhibit. And so the Science Museum will be a bold leader in important discussion. We will be a proud conservationist for our community. Our water quality research is number one in the nation. The St. Croix Watershed Research Station has scientists traveling all around the world for the government and all across this state to track how we manage our own water issues. Our exhibit, H2O Water Equals Life, is just opened at the Science Museum. We built it in conjunction with the American Museum of Natural History. We tested it there, toured it through Europe, and now we're restarting the U.S. tour here at the Science Museum of Minnesota. We will teach about stewardship. And stewardship is the story of this 100-year institution. 100 years ago, a dentist named Tiller traveled across the state in a coach pulled by horses and collected native seeds and grasses of Minnesota. For 100 years, the Science Museum of Minnesota has preserved that heritage. And today, when we check our biodiversity, it's the collections at the Science Museum that allows us to know where we were and where we're going. It's the collection of the Whipple materials, one of the largest gifted American Indian artifact collections in the world, that we preserve for the state of Minnesota. It's the collections of our current immigrant population, Somali and Hmong, that we preserve for the state of Minnesota, of our original pioneers and farmers that we preserve for the state of Minnesota. We have 1.75 million objects in our care that are about the heritage of the state, the nation, and the world, and it's centered here in Minnesota. And so I'm proud that our institution is the leading provider of teacher professional development, that we're the largest provider of exhibits to other science museums in the country, that we're the most viewed Omni Theater in all of America, more than any screen, Chicago, New York, Boston, or L.A., that we've produced more IMAX films than all other science museums in America combined, that from Minnesota, we are leading how education can be transformed to a museum. How much so? Well, when the U.S. House of Representatives had a hearing on out-of-school education programs, they only invited one science museum to be represented from the entire nation, and that was the Science Museum of Minnesota. When the European Union wanted to study out-of-school programs for science, they only invited one institution from all of North America to testify, and that was the Science Museum of Minnesota. We believe that this is the place where we create a local proof of concept for a national scale-up to change education. But to change education in the story of stewardship, which is, I think, pretty stunning. And so, our museum is an educational institution, a cultural resource, and an organization that creates dialogue that blurs the boundaries between science and art and culture, and says that in human life, they're all united. You're looking at a president of a science museum who has fair credentials as a scientist, but whose art has been acquired by the Smithsonian, the Roosevelt, the Quisenberry, the Rhode Island School of Design. You can't separate out science and art and life. We are an institution that has higher levels of earned income than almost any other museum of our size in America, and we serve a broad array of this state. As you can see from our impact, we reach 1 in 4 students in their classroom through our out-of-school program. We'll reach 1.2 million visitors in our museum this year. We will train teachers and create programs and work in assemblies for 85,000 students. We'll bring 140,000 students on field trips to the museum. And our summer camps will add another 40,000. And the programs that we do, which have minor margins like exhibit rentals, teacher training, we put that money to the benefit of the state. Last year, we offered to our Great Picks program 35,000 family memberships to low-income community members from across the state. And they don't need to come into the Science Museum and show how poor they are. We have trained over 100 United Way agencies that they're serving someone, whether it's WIC, food services, they can sell that ticket. For $1, you cross the transom with the same ticket as any other member. With your pride and dignity intact, and you take your family through an Omni film experience, to a museum, you get them engaged, you get them excited. I am thrilled that we're able to do this. I am frightened that in today's economy, the demands on our low-income programs will exceed my ability to underwrite it. I'm gratified that we took only a 5% cut in the governor's budget. But I don't know where we're going to go when the next low-income family knocks on my door and says, we'd like to show our children the joy of learning. And I have to say, I can't afford it anymore. This state can't afford to do that to our children. We are a museum that wants to inspire. And we have learned that teenagers are not getting inspired to go where their younger siblings are. I've met very few 15-year-olds who say, oh great, I want to go where my 12-year-old brother or sister went. They aspire to go where the 20-somethings go. And as we look at this state science education achievement levels, we know we're doing fine in 4th and 5th grade. But we're beginning to lose interest and impact when we get into high school. And so the Science Museum has really increased its efforts to reach those children. And so you'll see our programming, incredible programming, to attract the 20-somethings because that's where the 15-year-olds want to be. And you've seen exhibits like Pompeii. Only 5 cities in North America had that exhibit. Body World. Last month I returned from the Governor's Trade Mission to Israel and we, as announced in the press, sealed our deal. We are bringing back from Israel the Dead Sea Scrolls. In fact, the largest piece of the Book of Genesis ever displayed. We've also negotiated with the government because they've started excavating the Second Temple period. That's the period where Christ is reported to have turned over Changemaker's table, and it's an incredible experience in internationalization, believe it or not, of religion. We're bringing the tables. 2,000 years ago, a group of Israelites had preserved their sacred texts and were under attack by the Roman army. And they placed these texts in jars, hid them away in caves, on faith that they would reach a future they would not see, on faith that what they did would be preserved, on faith in a stewardship. And 2,000 years after placing those scrolls in a cave, and the year that Israel was founded, the scrolls were discovered, transmitted from a generation who had hopes of a state for their future to that state. We've compared those texts to the next recorded version of the Bible, the Leningrad Codex, 1,000 years later. We found 99% verbal concurrence. If you've ever played the game of telephone, you can't go from 5 people without losing the message. 1,000 years and no drift. So we thought we should look at what happens 2,000 years later. And as St. John provided the Bible to the Pope has started building a very special room to exhibit it, but they don't have it yet. So we called the Vatican. We are pairing the Dead Sea Scrolls with the excavations from the Second Temple period and the St. John's Bible to tell a story of stewardship that, like our 100-year history, reflects the faith of 2,000 years in giving back to our community. Our science museum is a remarkable place. I'm humbled to be able to provide leadership to the incredible group of talented people who help make this real. But I am more than humbled. I am proud and incredibly impressed that a state has supported an institution like this. A state from its people, much more so than its government. Our state funds amount to about 3% of our total budget, but it is an incredible 3%. It is the 3% that we leverage 30 times over with public support support from the National Science Foundation, support from the U.S. Department of Education, support from foundations across the state and nation. And they support us, to quote Cargill, because everyone has skin in this game. The state, the counties, the schools, and the museum. I hope that when you look at your very difficult decision, you'll help maintain the skin in the game that allows me to bring these resources to bear 30-fold more than your gift. We are an important cultural institution that tells the history and story of this state, that preserves it for a future we will not see, and does so with great faith that what we do matters for the well-being of our students and our future. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your time and indulgence.
Dr. Jolly, thank you very much for your passionate and eloquent testimony. Would one of you like to talk a little bit about the poster board over there? Ms. Rainey, are you going to have some words to add?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. My name is Brenda Rainey from the Science Museum of Minnesota. And this map here actually matches a map that you have on the back page of the brochure that was in your folder. And the facing page to that map also has the exact totals of children who visited the museum or had the museum visit them in their home school by county. So what that map indicates is our outreach to school children across the state of Minnesota, and it also indicates our outreach of research throughout the state. Dr. Jolly referenced the work that the St. Croix Watershed Research Station performs. That research station is located north of here in Marina and St. Croix, but they dispatch their scientists across the state to do water quality and water restoration research based by grants from places as varied as the DNR, the MPCA, other state agencies, and other national agencies to do water research for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rainey. Are there any questions for our presenters from the Science Museum? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering how we reached those last half dozen or so counties with outreach. The Science Museum, does the Science Museum make those decisions, or do the schools within the counties?
Ms. Rainey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, those decisions are made in partnership with districts. There is some nominal fee associated with outreach programs. These aren't programs that we're able to give away completely for free, though they are heavily subsidized. And every year this map will change slightly based on resources that districts have, based on the time that we have for our staff to get out to all areas of the state. And in recent years, based on different issues like testing pressures from districts, we've seen less districts able to devote the time to things like this because of that testing pressure.
Dr. Jolly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I would also add that while we hope to never miss a county, and we do our best not to, we've started a new partnership with MNSCU. The Science Museum of Minnesota has created what is one of the nation's leading teacher resource and professional development centers. Upon touring it, Chancellor James McCormick instructed three of his schools to learn to emulate the program, and we are creating parallel systems across the state in partnership with MNSCU. The Science Museum is giving away our technology skills and experience so that this can happen, and we know then that those districts will be served by these MNSCU partnerships.
Representative Haas.
Well, my question has been asked and answered, but I thought you should be able to find a friend in Rossoni. Oh.
Thank you. Representative Loffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our guests. One of the things that I think is key about our state investments in these wonderful institutions is public access. And you described how you have low-income access if people go through a WIC program or a low-income family-serving entity, it looks like maybe about 7% or so of your visitors might be through one of those programs. I did not hear you say that you offered any, like, free days. I have found the Science Museum rates both for the Omni Theater, even just the exhibits, going up higher and higher, and I'm seeing more and more families feeling like that's not an affordable experience for them. They may not participate in the very targeted programs. And have you given any consideration to, we heard about how the Children's Museum has some free days. I know the Walker and the Minneapolis Institute of Arts and a variety of entities have sort of adopted that kind of an approach to make sure that the doors are open to others, at least occasionally. Have you thought about those kind of approaches at all? If you have a broader outreach to, I think right now we're at, I think it's over 20% of our children are in low-income families, which is really sad.
Dr. Dahl?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilford, we have. It is a very challenging thing to maintain science museums who, nationally, we have science museums closing wings and some of them closing their doors. Our financial challenges are deep. We've had free days when they've been subsidized by such groups as the Minneapolis Foundation, and so we were able to open our doors for free and have record attendance on those days. 2 years ago, our best attendance ever was on Martin Luther King Day, and we're delighted when we can do that. We've tried programs that offered subsidies to middle-income families, and unfortunately our experience shows that they were used by upper middle-income families more than middle-income families. The good news is, in these trying economic times, our attendance among low-income and middle-income is up over 9%. And so we feel that given a chance to look at their discretionary budget, people are finding that we're of value. Our membership, of course, is a value-based membership. It allows unlimited movies access for families at less than the price of a family of four visiting twice. And we will hope, if we had the funding, I would offer free admission to everyone. I have to tell you. I just don't know how to keep our doors open otherwise. And our low-income programs have grown from 20,000 family members to 35,000 family members in just 3 years. I want to continue to grow those programs. I would love to add more free programming. And we do add free programming to our outreach partners. And so we're working with the people who are developing the new Y on North Broadway, who are going to be putting a science corner in that Y. We're working with Augsburg College as they're building a new science building. We're going to put a science corner in their building. All of those will be free access for the public.
Ms. Rainey?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Wofford. I also want to point out that while we do need to monitor our ticket price increases, and we did increase our ticket prices in 2008, we have not increased the price for student admission for school field trips along with the chaperones and teachers that accompany those schools since 2005, and at that point we only increased that price by 50 cents. So we do try to keep the school field trip attendance reasonable to encourage that access. And another piece that's sort of interesting is if you take the number of visitors divided by the annual budget of the Science Museum and just say that would be the true cost of what it would take to attend the museum, that figure is $43. So already the $16 admission and Omni Theater ticket price is heavily subsidized.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Dollard, has there been any measurement of outcomes in terms of how participating in science museum programs enhances abilities in math and science?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Kahn.
Thank you very much for that question. Yes, in a survey by the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, they reported that 40% of their members were actively engaged as young people in science museums, and 20% attribute their selection as a career in engineering and science to have been their family membership in science museums. We've also published a study on the Trilogy for Student Success, Engagement Capacity and Continuity, which is a required read for the Education Division in the National Science Foundation, which looks at how science museums increase the engagement of students, move them towards an increase in capacity, and have programs that successfully offer continuity, that is, letting students know the next step to go. In our own educational programs, we've done a series of evaluations. We have
3 full-time evaluators at the Science Museum, funded by grants from the National Science Foundation, that look at how we demonstrate success. I have always been frustrated at what Tom Kibler called the pure of heart model. Many people who do educational reform do it with a pure of heart model. If my heart is pure and my intentions are good, I must be doing the right thing. Well, you can have a pure heart and great intentions, but not increase students' activity and engagement. We actively measure what students' homework completion rate is when they've been through a science museum visit and what their attendance in school is. And we increase attendance, decrease absenteeism, and increase homework attendance rate. We have a full report, and I'd be very happy to provide that to you. I think we've got some of the best data in the nation from science museums. Let me qualify that by saying it's easy to be the best when there's not a lot. But we hope to add more.
Representative Kahn?
What about the additional issue that we come up against with math and science, and that's the disparity related to both women and also to economic
circumstances? Dr. Jolly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, there has been some preliminary research on this which came out of Tufts University and out of the Massachusetts Reform Effort, which the Science Museum of Minnesota is a partnership with. And we are showing that when you give young women hands-on activities in math and science that show the application of mathematics to solve real-world problems, we close what I call the aspiration gap. There's a stunning fact. Prior to Title IX, women in engineering and the sciences constituted only 2% of the enrollment in colleges. We had large and capable graduating force of high school girls who wanted math and science, but because of scholarship and other limiting factors that Title IX removed, they were not able to apply. Shortly after Title IX, we saw an increase to 12% and then eventually to 20% of women in engineering. But in the last decade, that percentage has declined continuously. In Minnesota, in the last year in which the ACT tracked preferences, females in Minnesota dropped from 6% interest in engineering to 4%. We don't have an achievement gap, we have an aspiration gap. And the research coming out of Tufts says that if we can give young women hands-on experiences, we can close that gap. Science Museum of Minnesota has received a $2.4 million grant from Cargill to install the first district-wide engineering curriculum for elementary school students that's ever been tested in the nation. We hope that we will be able to demonstrate that this will close the aspiration and subsequently the achievement gap. These programs have been successful on a school-by-school basis. It's never been tested on a district-wide implementation. If our district-wide implementation is successful, it will be rolled out across the state.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a series of questions. On your organizational chart, I've been impressed with the leadership that her participation leadership that Ms. Rainey and Mr. Murphy have been given, but I don't find Mr. Murphy on the chart. Is he a full-time employee, or is he someplace else?
Ms. Rainey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy. Tom Murphy is actually a contract staff, so he is not an employee of the Science Museum. My position, Director of Government Relations, is there on the organizational chart. And again, Mr. Murphy is a contract to the Science, is on contract to the Science Museum.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. And the Distinguished Chair of Museum Leadership, is that an appointed position or an elected position by the board or what?
Ms. Rainey?
Okay.
Dr. Johnson?
Thank you.
Dr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Distinguished Chair of Museum Leadership was made possible by a generous donation from John Rowe, a former trustee of the Science Museum in Minnesota. It's a position which is made available and renewed annually by a national search among our senior museum leadership staff. In that position today, We have a person who is the former CEO of the New Jersey Aquarium and a lead program officer for the National Science Foundation of her 14 offers when she left the National Science Foundation. The one she jumped at was the Science Museum of Minnesota, and she continues to provide us with national leadership and bring in programming dollars from organizations around the nation. This is a position which will only be maintained so long as there is donor funding to support it. It is not a budgeted line of the museum.
Representative Murphy.
And Dr. Jolly, how many senior leadership positions are there?
Dr. Jolly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are 6 senior leadership positions, 6 vice presidents at the Science Museum of Minnesota, supervising 650 full and part-time employees with a 350 FTE equivalent.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. And some of your field trips are sleepovers, right? Is there a difference in the... You said that you followed their homework assignments and their test results and so forth. Is there a difference between the day trippers and the sleepover people in the results of their academic achievements that you know of?
Ms. Rain?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the camp-in program that you're speaking of, where people actually sleep overnight in the museum, is a bit more difficult to track homework completion and attendance rates, because typically those students aren't coming, they're not always coming from classrooms, they're coming from Girl Scout troops, from church groups, from homeschoolers, different organizations like that will sign up for a camp-in. Sometimes, absolutely, a classroom will sign up for a camp-in, but it, again, makes the tracking of that kind of data a lot more difficult when they're diversified in that way.
I know of,
Murphy.
In my district, there's several students that camped out 3 years ago,
okay.
And they're mature middle schoolers now, 8th grade, and they are still talking with great excitement about that one night that they had at the Science Museum.
Thank you, Chair Representative. Thank you very much for that testimony. We've changed, and I hope the reason they're still excited about it is we've changed what gets them excited. 5 years ago, we used to do a disservice to our teachers. Children would come off the bus to do a camp-in, and they'd get all excited about dinosaurs, and they would send them back to school, and there were no dinosaurs. Now, when children get off the bus or come to our camp-in, they're given a NASS backpack. They have a pith helmet. They have a scientific logbook and journal. They have rulers and calipers and measuring devices and magnifying glasses. And they go throughout the museum, and they measure the thigh bone of a dinosaur and even the thigh bone of their teacher. And last year, we trained 1,200 teachers in how to use that data set for students' math engagement in middle school. What we get them excited about is what their teachers get to use. And we think that's a key to our success. And so our overnight camp-ins include the kinds of activities that will allow children to continuously refresh their memories of the Science Museum through the classroom engagement. And that's been an important asset for us.
Ms. Rainey.
Mr. Chair, Representative, just to piggyback on what Dr. Jolly is speaking of, we're also doing programming. It's in its beginning stages now. We're hoping to roll it out in greater detail to provide parents that same kind of material that will help them maintain that engagement with their children at home after a visit to the museum. And that's something that we're very dedicated to and proud of.
Representative Murphy.
In total, how many different teacher preparation courses do you offer?
Ms. Rainey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we are offering this summer, the summer is our heaviest time to offer professional development for training, and this summer I believe we're offering 8 to 10 separate week-long institutes for teachers to come in and train. We also are offering sessions throughout the course of the school year typically not the week-long institute simply because of the constraints of the school year calendar. But for example, one day last week we had over 100 teachers in our building through the MNSTA, the State Department of Education Professional Development Program. We are a strong partner with MASTA, and we had 100 teachers in on a work day from that organization, and we offer those periodically throughout the year.
Dr. Gullis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I might add to that, we will always have teacher professional development courses that allow teachers to advance their certification and other credentials. However, one of the things that we're growing very rapidly is the continuous engagement of teachers as professionals. When I go back to my alma mater where I received my doctorate, and I sit on the other side of the desk of my MAGE professor, I have been a dean, an assistant chancellor, I've tenured people beyond her credentials, but I'm still her graduate student and she's still my MAGE professor. And often when teachers go back to a university classroom, they're still a student. We want to help solidify the sense of professionalism that teachers get. And so we've put together a program in what's called Science House, a separate building at the Science Museum, and we give our member teachers their own parking space and their own access key. And we encourage them to stop by after school and have coffee and hot chocolate year-round. On given evenings, they'll know that there will be a scientist on site, and so if you're a fifth-grade teacher and you have to teach geology, bring in a rock. There'll be a geologist there on Wednesday who will make that rock come alive in ways you may not have thought about. We will allow you to also, on certain evenings, train in a piece of curriculum, much like a FOSS kit for adoption science. And you'll leave with the kit and materials and bring it into the classroom the next day. If you want, we'll ship a braided stream, desktop size, or one of 120 complete mammal skeletons to your classroom. We'll teach you how to use it. Our membership in that program has doubled every year for the last 2 years since we started it. It is 8 times above our budget and projection. And what we're delighted with is it's not a course. It's a continuous referencing of self as a professional in an institution that recognizes and honors that for teachers. And that's the program which is being modeled by MNSCU and which we're going to bring across the state wherever possible. So we will do teacher training. But I have to tell you, I am delighted with the number of contact hours that happen in a professional resource center for teachers.
Ms. Rainey?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, I also want to just expand a little bit on what Dr. Jolly said about the ability to check materials out from this science house. That's a stunning example of shared resources that we have right now. And we have a whole host of materials that teachers at all age levels can use in their classrooms, and it allows them to not have to purchase those materials within their own district. Things like, you know, like a microscopes, college-grade microscopes, that a district doesn't have to purchase for the 1 week out of the year that their classroom will use that microscope. They can come to the Science Museum, check them out, bring them back to their classroom, use them for their lesson, and then bring them back. It's an incredible cost savings for districts across the state.
Representative Murphy?
And then, Dr. Jolly, when you began your presentation, you talked about federal money that was coming in from National Science Foundation. And could you give us more of an understanding of what that amounts to and how many different grants or and the total amount of federal money that is part of your budget?
Dr. Jolly, Mr. Chair, Representative, the Science Museum has become increasingly competitive with the National Science Foundation and other resources to bring materials to Minnesota. Some of those materials and resources are also distributed outside of Minnesota. So, for example, we lead a 100 museum coalition on nanotechnology. We share a multi-million-dollar five-year grant with 2 other institutions. We lead the National Center for Earth Surface Dynamics Public Outreach. That's shared with 12 different universities across the nation. We lead the Small Fluid Hydrodynamics Efforts, a $100 million program of the National Science Foundation, in their public outreach. that the grant shared with 26 universities nationwide. So we do a lot of programming which moves beyond our boundaries, but our total resources from the National Science Foundation and federal grants this year will be $5.6 million. I should note that many of these grants are multi-year grants, so it's $5.6 million total in this year. Some of those grants are $5 million total of themselves, spread over 3 to 5 years. One of the interests that the Science Museum has in cultural heritage funding is being able to offer the kind of match with a stability that is not on a biennium budget, but which has a longer window than just 2 years. Because our grants have a longer window than 2 years, and we're investing a lot of faith that our state won't desert us. So our grant funding has increased dramatically in the last 5 years. As I said, we are now the largest recipient in the nation from National Science Foundation. I hope to be able to come back and say that will be true of the Department of Education in a couple of years.
And on the organization part, is the grant writer, does that have a special title? Or do many people write grants?
Ms. Rain.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, many people write grants. We do have one individual on the organizational chart who would fall into that development department on the far left, whose primary responsibility is to work with the myriad of staff throughout multiple divisions who are writing grants. The bulk of our grant writing comes in our exhibits and education departments, but we do have a significant amount also in science and to a lesser degree in museum enterprises.
I think we do have time for one more quick question, Representative Torkelson.
Very quick.
Representative Torkelson with a quick question and hopefully a quick answer.
Thank you, Chair. Really more of a comment. Thank you, Dr. Jolly, for coming today. I just wanted to iterate that my wife, a third grade teacher, is taking part in their Science House program, and we live in greater Minnesota. And I was going to have a bit of a complaint because it's sometimes difficult to coordinate schedules when you're driving in from outstate. She's even had to stoop so low as to recruit a house member to bring back shark jaws to your Science House. So I'm very glad to hear that you're cooperating with Minsky and reaching out to greater Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. We have at least one announcement. I'd like to start with Representative Murphy about the homework.
Yes. Members and audience, regulars, assignment 6 is on the table and in your packets and online, I believe. Using the process goals and the project goals that we received at the last meeting, I'm asking you to number your choices 1 to 5 in priority order for the process goals and number your choices 1 to 5 in priority order for project goals. Both members, staff, and audience all together. So both sides of the sheet. 2 sheets you have. And then turn them in to me or Mr. Chen by 4 p.m. tomorrow.
Also, before we have any other announcements, I'd like to recognize a group of students in the audience from McAllister College. They are working in environmental policy, probably our future environmental leaders, as so often happens out of McAllister College. Let's give them a nice welcome, if you would. I'm sorry, Representative Lilly?
Maybe Representative Hansen has an introduction, too.
Perhaps he does, but I know his wife and I went to school with her, and sometimes she's a little shy, so we'll welcome her as well. Are there any other announcements? Meeting is adjourned.